Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 26th of January, 2010, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 25 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Yes, 25! We've finally reached our quarter century. But what is Reality Check? Well, Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week, we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific, and finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to continue our examination, begun last week, of the alternative medicine known as homeopathy. Last week, it was all looking pretty implausible. Will it get any better this week, or only continue on its downward spiral into absurdity? Well, stay tuned and all will be revealed. Then, in our movie review, we'll delve into the post-apocalyptic world of The Road. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, now just before we get into our LGBT news roundup for today, I just wanted to make a quick comment about today's date. Today is January 26, and in Australia it's a public holiday for the country's National Day, known as Australia Day. However, we at Reality Check do not commemorate or celebrate or recognise this so-called National Day in any way. Let me explain why. Partly it's because we don't believe in patriotism. We find it to be an irrational concept without merit. But most importantly, we believe that celebrating Australia Day on January 26th is profoundly racist and deeply offensive. Now, we do have a number of overseas listeners here on Reality Check, both online and via the podcast. So for their benefit, I'll briefly explain the situation. January 26 is certainly a date of historical significance. It is the date in 1788 on which the first Europeans, namely the British, arrived in Australia to begin the process of conquest, colonisation, and settlement. So it's certainly a significant date. But to make that date the national holiday, the day on which all Australians are supposed to celebrate, is so breathtakingly racist and offensive as to defy belief. At least to anyone born outside Australia. To most people born in Australia, it's the way it's always been, so it seems perfectly normal. It's as if the country is saying, well, let's just conveniently forget the fact that millions of people had been living here for thousands of years before 1788, and let's just celebrate the arrival of the first white people on the continent, and expect everyone to join in. And when you explain this situation to most people overseas, they understand how offensive it is. Would you expect to see Mexicans celebrating their National Day on the day that the Spanish first landed on Mexican soil to begin a long, slow process of conquest, enslavement, and genocide? No. What about Nigeria or India? Do they celebrate their national day on the day the British first arrived to begin the colonization of their territory? No, they don't. And yet most Australians seem to think it's perfectly reasonable for Australia to do so. So, for the Australian listeners out there who still don't quite get what the problem is, let me try to put it in another perspective. Imagine that next Monday, February 1st, 2010, the Chinese army appears in Sydney Harbour and begins a long, bloody, and brutal armed conquest of Australia. And after several years, they finally succeed in taking over the whole continent. Mandarin is then imposed as the national language, and a version of the Chinese flag is adopted as the national flag. Millions of Australians are then murdered by the Chinese over the next few decades with complete impunity. And millions more succumb to strange exotic Chinese diseases, like SARS, for example. Many non-Chinese Australians are forcibly sent off to live in reservations, and some have their children taken away from them to try to integrate them into Chinese society. Non-Chinese Australians are denied the vote, ridiculed, discriminated against, and marginalised. Then, in 100 years from now, when the country is celebrating its national day, Australia Day, on February 1st, 2110, would you expect to see the few remaining non-Chinese Australians to be smiling and waving their little Sino-Australian flags, celebrating the glorious day on which the genocide of their ancestors began? No, you wouldn't expect that, and you might think that February the 1st is perhaps not the most appropriate day on which to celebrate a national holiday. Well, I'd have to agree with you, and I find celebrating Australia's National Day on January 26 just as inappropriate and just as insensitive. And I really hope that Australians come to their senses soon and this highly offensive tradition does not continue for much longer. By the way, just as a clarification before I start to get angry emails, I hope listeners understand that I don't have anything against Chinese people. I'm just using China as an example of a powerful country with a very different culture from the standard Anglo-Celtic Australian culture. All right, now that I've got that out of the way, let's get on with our LGBT news roundup for the last week or so. And first up, let's head over to what is geographically the world's largest country, Russia, which is unfortunately a deeply homophobic country in general, and also a country with a pretty dismal record on LGBT rights. But activists there are trying, slowly but persistently, to turn the situation around, mostly through legal actions. One example is the lesbian couple Irina Fedotova-Fet and Irina Shipitko, who are trying to get same-sex marriage introduced in Russia through the courts. They applied for a marriage license at a Moscow registry office in May last year, but unsurprisingly were refused. They sought to overturn that decision in a district court in Moscow, but the court upheld the refusal of their marriage license. And so they appealed that decision to the Moscow City Court, which last Thursday, January 21st, also upheld the refusal of the registry office to issue them a marriage license. The couple will now appeal to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg in France. In the meantime, just to complicate things a bit, the couple also went to Canada last October and got married, really married, over there in Toronto. So I understand they're also planning to bring a separate case for the recognition by Russia of their overseas marriage. I certainly wish them luck, especially in the European Court of Human Rights, but I have to admit I'm not very hopeful that they'll get a good decision there, especially given that only 5 countries in Europe so far have introduced same-sex marriage. Apparently, there are also two other same-sex marriage cases currently before the European Court of Human Rights, one from Austria and one from France. So when those cases are decided sometime later this year, hopefully, that will presumably set some kind of precedent for the next few years. It's all a bit complicated, but we will, of course, keep you up to date with whatever happens here on Reality Check. Meanwhile, there is another LGBT rights case that's been brought against Russia in the European Court of Human Rights. This is a case arising from the repeated banning for 4 years running now of the Moscow Gay Pride Parade by the mayor of Moscow, Yuri Luzhkov. Last week, it looked as if that case might finally be heard fairly soon. But unfortunately, the Russian government requested more time to prepare its response, and that was granted by the court last week. So both sides, the Pride March organizers and the Russian authorities, will now head back to court on February 20th. Meanwhile, Moscow Pride is preparing for its fifth consecutive attempt to stage a Pride March in Moscow on May 29th this year. And unfortunately, with this delay in the European Court of Human Rights, it looks like we won't be seeing a final decision before then, most likely. All previous attempts to hold gay pride marches in Moscow, beginning in 2006, ended with violent arrests by the police, and in some cases, marches were bashed by anti-gay protesters as the police stood by and watched. In the past, the Moscow mayor has called gay pride parades satanic and, according to some reports, even weapons of mass destruction. And he reaffirmed those views just yesterday in a speech at an Orthodox religious event called the International Christmas Educational Readings, whatever that is. Mayor Luzhkov said, and I quote, "For years, Moscow has faced unprecedented pressure to hold a gay parade, which can only be described as a satanic act. We did not allow such a parade then, and we will not allow one in the future. It's no time to mess around with talk of human rights. Rather, we should crack down with all the power and justice of the law. We need a social whip, or something like that. Not a liberal ginger cake." End quote. What a charming man the mayor of Moscow is. So a very grim situation there in Moscow for LGBT people. And I tell you what, I wouldn't be game to try staging a pride march there, having seen videos of how violently the marches have been treated. So I reckon the LGBT activists in Moscow these days really have a lot of guts and deserve a lot of respect. Now, finally, briefly for our last news item for today, let's head back to California where the Perry versus Schwarzenegger case is continuing. This is that constitutional case in the US federal court seeking a ruling that the Proposition 8 referendum that banned same-sex marriage in California in 2008 was unconstitutional. It's now entering its third week and has just completed its 10th day of hearings. And yesterday morning, that's Monday, January 25th, the plaintiffs, that is our side, called their last witnesses to give evidence and then wrapped up their case. Then yesterday afternoon, the defense began calling their witnesses to try to make the case that banning same-sex marriage is okay under the federal constitution. The defense will probably only have two or three witnesses, and then the evidential arguments will close, most likely today or tomorrow, California time. Then there'll be a break for a few weeks before both sides come back to give their closing arguments sometime in February, most likely. I won't go into all the nitty-gritty of what all the various witnesses have been saying, but it's been a very interesting trial with lots of very smart witnesses being called and a lot of intelligent arguments being made. And it's certainly been attracting a lot of media attention, which is great. And we will, of course, always keep you posted of progress in this historic trial here on Reality Check. Okay, that concludes our LGBT news roundup for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll continue our skeptical analysis of homeopathy. Do those little round sugar balls really do anything, or is it all complete quackery? Well, to find out, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Made in Melbourne for the world. Joy 94.9.
Let's take a trip to examine this common basis of life, a voyage to investigate the molecular machinery at the heart of life on Earth.
All life is related, and it enables us to construct with confidence the complex tree that represents the history of life. Our planet, the Earth, is, as far as we know, unique in the universe. It contains life. Here, plants and animals proliferate in such numbers that we still have not even named all the different species. Darwin's great insight revolutionized the way in which we see the world. We now understand why there are so many different species.
Every cell is a triumph of natural selection, and we're made of trillions of cells. In us is a little universe. Those are some of the things that molecules do. Given 4 billion years of evolution, we are, each of us, a multitude.
Now, how did the molecules of life arise?
It began in the sea some 3,000 million years ago. Complex chemical molecules began to clump together.
These were the seeds from which the tree of life developed. They were able to split, replicating themselves as bacteria do.
The secrets of evolution are time and death. There's an unbroken thread that stretches from those first cells to us. The secrets of evolution are time and death. There's an unbroken thread that stretches from those first cells to us. Every cell is a triumph of natural selection, and we're made of trillions of cells. In us is a little universe. Those are some of the things that molecules do. Given 4 billion years of evolution, we are, each of us, a multitude.
There isn't a sharp line dividing humans from the rest of the animal kingdom. It's a very wuzzy line. It's a very wuzzy line. It's getting wuzzier all the time. We find animals doing things that we, in our arrogance, used to think was just human. It's a very wuzzy line, and it's getting wuzzier all the time.
Every cell is a triumph of natural selection, and we're made of trillions of cells. In us is a little universe. Those are some of the things that molecules do. Given 4 billion years of evolution, we are, each of us, a multitude. Every cell is a triumph of natural selection, and we're made of trillions of cells. In us is a little universe.
Our planet, the Earth, is, as far as we know, unique in the universe. It contains life. Its continued survival now rests in our hands.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman, and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was The Unbroken Thread, which is the fourth song now available on the symphonyofscience.com website. And that one, obviously, if you were listening closely, is based on an evolution theme and features the voices of Carl Sagan, the late great American astronomer, David Attenborough, the British documentary maker, and Jane Goodall, the famous British primatologist. To check out the other three songs made using voice tuning technology, just visit symphonyofscience.com. We move now into the part of the show where we undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And today we're going to continue our examination of homeopathy. But before we do that, I just wanted to make a brief comment about the earthquake in Haiti. Now, 3 weeks ago on Reality Check, in our first show of 2010, we had a look at some of the predictions that the world's supposedly greatest psychics were making for the upcoming year. Then, just days later, on Tuesday the 12th of January, the magnitude 7 earthquake struck in Haiti. It was a truly massive disaster. 2 days ago, the Haitian authorities estimated that they had already buried 150,000 victims. This would make it not just one of the most devastating earthquakes in recent times, but clearly in the top 10 most deadly earthquakes in the history of the world. Strange, then, isn't it that such an immense tragedy, all that human suffering and misery on a truly unimaginable scale, strange that that didn't register even as a little blip on the radars of the world's great psychics. Even stranger still, given the proximity in time. It occurred just a few days after they made their predictions, and the proximity and location. I mean, Haiti is in the Caribbean, just southeast of the United States, where most of the famous psychics are located. So we had one of the most destructive natural disasters in the history of the world, just days away, and yet none of the psychics predicted it. Strange, isn't it? I wonder what possibly could have gone wrong. Maybe the skeptics were sending out bad vibes that interfered with their psychic signals. Yeah, that's probably it. I did check out a few psychic websites over the last couple of days, and some of them are claiming, and this is for real, that they had psychic visions of the Haiti earthquake shortly before it happened, but didn't rush to their computers to put it up on their websites because they didn't realize it was so urgent. Until they saw the news about the disaster on TV, and by then it was too late to warn people. Oh, darn it all. Don't you just hate it when that happens? Okay, enough about our beloved psychic friends. Let's move on now to continue the analysis that we began last week of the alternative medicine known as homeopathy. Now, if you're just tuning in for the first time today and didn't hear last week's episode, you can download it along with all previous episodes of Reality Check at our website, realitycheckonline.net. So last week we had a look at the history of homeopathy, the life of its founder, Samuel Hahnemann, and the first basic principle of homeopathy, the so-called law of similars, or the idea that like cures like. And we concluded that the law of similars is not actually based in reality. It's not a biological or medical principle. Like, in fact, doesn't cure like. A substance, normally a toxic substance, that causes the same symptoms in a person as the disease you're trying to treat, will not cure the person of that disease. It will probably just make them worse. Let me give you one further example of why this is such a ridiculous idea. If someone has the symptom of fever, let's say, this could be caused by a virus, a bacterium, a yeast or fungi, a parasite like malaria, a cancer like lymphoma or leukemia, a blood clot, an allergic reaction, an autoimmune disease, anemia, some kind of poison, etc., etc. In other words, the same symptom, fever, could be caused by any number of very different underlying pathologies, requiring very different treatments. To apply the principle of like cures like and say you should treat a fever by giving someone a small amount of toxin that also causes fever is just absurd. There's no other word for it. So today we're going to have a look at one of the other fundamental premises on which homeopathy is based, to see if it stands up to scientific scrutiny, unlike the so-called law of similars. And the premise that we're going to look at today is known as the law of infinitesimals. That is the idea that the more you dilute an active ingredient, the more potent it becomes. That is, the stronger the beneficial effects become, while the harmful effects become weaker. Now, that seems completely counterintuitive and absurd, but let me try to put this in the best possible light I can. Now, you might be able to draw an analogy here with a topic we looked at a couple of weeks ago here on Reality Check, vitamins. Let's take vitamin A, for example. If you have too much vitamin A, you die. If you have no vitamin A, you also die. So you need just the right amount to stay alive and be healthy. And you could make a similar analogy with a number of pharmaceuticals out there. Too much would cause an overdose. You need just the right amount to get a beneficial effect. However, this is not what the homeopaths are saying, because their system has no lower limit. They honestly believe that the more you dilute an ingredient, the stronger the dose. And as we mentioned last week, most homeopathic remedies have been diluted so much that there's not one single molecule of the so-called active ingredient left. And this is considered a high dose to the homeopaths. And you can even dilute that, pure water, to make it an even higher dose, supposedly. This is probably the most ridiculous principle of homeopathy. It defies all basic science, chemistry, biology, and physics. In science-based medicine, medications work because they contain molecules of an active ingredient. These molecules cause an effect in the body by binding to receptors on our cell membranes. That's the basis of the whole science of pharmacology, looking at how these molecules actually interact with human cells. Yet homeopathic theory holds that the fewer of these active molecules there are, the stronger the effect will be. And if you have no molecules at all, the effect will be at its strongest. It is totally ridiculous. And it's not even clear how Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, came up with this principle. I suspect it was some kind of wishful thinking because he didn't want to give his patients toxic doses of the poisons he was using in most homeopathic preparations. He just came up with the convenient idea that, oh, I know, let's just say that we can dilute it and so the toxic side effects go away, but the good effects increase. Yeah, that sounds nice, doesn't it? Well, yeah, it does sound nice. Nonsensical, but certainly nice. Now, let me take a little detour here and let's travel back in time and look briefly at the theories of another historical European, this time the Italian scientist Amedeo Avogadro. Avogadro was born in 1776, 21 years after Samuel Hahnemann. Now, the name might sound familiar to you because you may have learnt Avogadro's law at high school. This is a law about gases that says that equal volumes of ideal gases at the same temperature and pressure contain the same number of molecules. Remember that from school? Well, good, but it's not actually Avogadro's law that interests us today. It's another principle of chemistry known as the Avogadro constant. This number was not actually devised by Avogadro himself, but rather was named after him a century or so later in the early 1900s. And this number refers to the number of atoms or molecules of any particular substance in one mole of that substance. The definition of a mole is the number of carbon atoms in 12 grams of carbon-12. And that number is approximately 6 by 10 to the 23. Now, why am I telling you this? Well, don't worry too much about the details. The important thing to remember is that because there are a finite number of atoms or molecules in any small quantity of a substance, there is a limit to the number of times you can dilute that substance and still retain a possibility of finding one molecule of that substance in the dilution. And that limit is called Avogadro's limit. And it is 10 to the power of 24. So if you have 12 grams of pure carbon, that is 6 by 10 to the 23 carbon atoms, and you take that carbon, let's imagine it as something like graphite dust from your pencil, and you manage to dilute it in water and keep on diluting it, well, once you've diluted it by a factor of 10 to the power 24, it is likely that you'll find just one atom of the original carbon in your solution. Go beyond that, and even the chances of finding just one atom drop off rapidly. Now, you may think, gosh, 10 to the power 24, that sounds like an awful lot. But that's just a 1 in 10 dilution 24 times. Or a 1 in 100 dilution 12 times. And you can easily do that in a few minutes on your kitchen bench. So why is all this relevant? Well, because a lot of the time, so-called homeopathic remedies have been diluted so much that they've gone beyond Avogadro's limit. So there's almost no chance of finding even one single molecule of the so-called active ingredient. So the question that arises is, well, how can you tell how far a substance has been diluted in a homeopathic remedy? Well, just look on the side of the bottle. Homeopathic dilutions are defined using the Roman numerals X or C. X meaning a 1 in 10 dilution, C meaning a 1 in 100 dilution. So if you see a 6X dilution of arnica, for example, that's a poisonous plant used often in homeopathic remedies, that means that the arnica has been diluted 1 in 10 6 times. That's a dilution of 1 in 10 to the power 6, or 1 in a million. So that hasn't gone beyond Avogadro's limit, so it will almost certainly contain some molecules of arnica. And fortunately, arnica is not a very toxic plant, so hopefully it won't be too poisonous for the patient. Okay, but what about if you see a dilution of, say, 12C? Well, it doesn't sound like much, does it? 12C. But let's have a look at that more closely. 12C is a 1 in 100 dilution 12 times. That's the same as a 1 in 10 dilution 24 times. And that's exactly Avogadro's limit. That's a dilution of 1 in 10 to the power 24. Now that's a 1 with 24 zeros after it. Now that's a serious dilution. If you don't believe me, write it out. 1, then 24 zeros. It's a massive number. And who knows if it now contains even one molecule of the original substance? Maybe, maybe not. And that's just 12C. Samuel Hahnemann recommended using most remedies in the 30C dilution. 30C, that's a 1 in 100 dilution 30 times. Or a 1 in 10 dilution 60 times. That's a dilution of 1 in 10 to the power 60. Now that's a big number. That's a 1 with 60 zeros after it. Try to write down that number, I dare you, to get an idea of the size of the dilutions we're talking about here. The probability that even one molecule of the original ingredient remains is unimaginably low. And yet, when you go down to your local chemist and have a look at some of the homeopathic remedies they've got on sale, you'll see that a lot of them are in the order of 30x or even 30c. That is well and truly beyond Avogadro's limit. So the only thing you'll be buying if you buy that so-called remedy is pure water or a pure pill of sugar. So finally, let me just give you a couple of real-world examples to show how ridiculously large these dilutions are. Let's look at the 12C dilution. Now it really doesn't sound much, does it? 12C. 1 in 100, 12 times. Well, as we saw before, that's Avogadro's limit. And a 12C dilution of salt would be equivalent to dissolving a pinch of salt in the entire Atlantic Ocean. And if you increase the dilution to 13C, it would be the equivalent of dissolving a pinch of salt in 100 Atlantic Oceans. You see, this is the real point to understand here. Going from a 12C to a 13C dilution is not just increasing the dilution a little bit, it's increasing it 2 orders of magnitude. Every power of 10 is another order of magnitude. That's what you really need to keep in mind when looking at homeopathic dilutions. And here's another interesting figure. If you keep diluting like this, by the time you get to 40C, you would have an equivalent strength of one molecule of ingredient per area the size of the entire observable universe. And that's just 40C. Some homeopathic preparations use a 200C dilution. For example, the common flu remedy, oscillococcinum, made from duck, heart and liver, is a 200C dilution. That's a dilution of 1 part per 1 with 400 zeros after it. And people actually buy these products. I've seen homeopathic websites on the internet saying things like, depending on the severity of the illness, sometimes you need a much more potent 200C remedy than the milder 30C. Yeah, and if I sell you this bottle of pure water for $20 instead of this bottle of pure water for $10, you'll thank me for it. Yes, dear listener, some people really are that stupid. Now, speaking of oscillococcinum, there is a very interesting story I'd like to tell you about that particular product. That's the 200C dilution of duck, heart and liver. Oscillococcinum is manufactured by a French company called Boiron and is one of the top 10 selling drugs in France. And as Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst point out in their book, Trick or Treatment, Boiron only has to slaughter one duck to get one heart and one liver to make enough remedy for the entire world market. And I downloaded the Boiron 2008 annual report to get an idea of how big that world market is, and discovered that in 2008, Boiron had worldwide sales of $658 million. Now, they sell other homeopathic remedies as well, but Oscillococcinum is their biggest selling product. So I don't know exactly how much they made from Oscillococcinum alone, but one can imagine it's in the order of about $100 million. Yes, that's right, dear listener, $100 million from one duck. That has got to be the most valuable animal on the planet. But actually, when you think about it, it's somehow appropriate. People who are making an absolute fortune from pure quackery do it with a duck. Get it? Duck? Quackery? It's a joke. Okay, never mind. So, in summary then, the second great law of homeopathy, the law of infinitesimals, just like the law of similars, is not a law at all. It's just an idea that Samuel Hahnemann made up, and no one really knows why. And it doesn't correspond to reality in any way. Any chemist or pharmacologist will tell you that if you decrease the dose, you decrease the effect, because you have fewer molecules to bind to cell receptors. And if you decrease the dose to zero, you will have zero effect. It's logical, really. So which part don't the homeopaths understand? Well, you see, they have ways to wriggle out of this apparently insurmountable problem in their theory. Now, even the homeopaths can't deny the fact that most of their remedies contain no molecules of an active ingredient. That is just a law of science that they can't avoid. But the way they get around it is by saying, yes, okay, we recognize that our remedies contain no active ingredients, but the water that remains retains the memory of the ingredient. Huh? Come again? Water has a memory? Yes, say the homeopaths. And to find out if that is true, dear listener, I'm afraid you'll have to wait until next week's episode of Reality Check, because unfortunately, we've run out of time today. So to find out if water really does have a memory, or whether homeopathy is pure bunkum from beginning to end, tune in to Reality Check at 10 o'clock next Tuesday here on Joy 94.9. Now, finally, before we get into our last song, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, that's T-O-N-Y, at gmail.com. You can also visit our website at realitycheckonline.net to find past episodes of Reality Check. Okay, let's listen to our final song, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Cruising for joy? It's safe listening. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au. And also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Sambolera Mai Son by a pop singer from Burundi known as Kaja Nin. And that song was released in 1995. Okay, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the movie up for review this week is The Road, the latest Hollywood take on what life will be like after the apocalypse. The Road is based on the 2006 best-selling and Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name by Cormac McCarthy. Yes, he who also wrote No Country for Old Men. The movie of The Road was directed by Australian director John Hillcoat and stars Viggo Mortensen. The film tells the story of a man and his young son, about 12 years old, who are trying to make their way to the coast after an apocalypse has destroyed almost all life on Earth. The nature of the apocalypse is never fully explained, but it was presumably some kind of nuclear war that has now caused a nuclear winter to engulf the planet. Within the first few minutes of the film, Viggo Mortensen's voiceover tells us that all animal and plant life has been killed. The world is cold and growing colder every day as everything slowly dies. The only visible sign of life are the few human survivors, and as nothing will grow, the only food they can get to eat is either stores of preserved food that survived the apocalypse or each other. Bands of cannibals roam the countryside looking for fresh meat. So with that setup, you can pretty much tell that this movie is not exactly going to be a light-hearted romp through the countryside. And actually, light is not an adjective that I would use to describe this film in any way. Certainly not for the subject matter, which remains very grim throughout, and certainly not for the look of the film either. As the world is now in an eternal winter, all the scenes in the movie have a washed-out, dull, grey look. It all looks so cold and so bleak. So, is The Road any good? Well, I would recommend going along to check it out. It's not a masterpiece, but it's well-crafted cinema and pretty gripping throughout. There is a very palpable sense of tension and dread and impending danger throughout the whole film. The stakes faced by the characters are about as high as they can be. Be very careful, because if you make one false move, you'll be captured and eaten by cannibals. It certainly keeps them on their toes and you on the edge of your seat for a lot of the film. And the best parts of the film are those nerve-wracking moments of danger. There's one particular sequence where they discover a seemingly deserted house and go inside and venture down into the cellar. Now, I won't tell you what happens, but the tension in that scene in particular is almost unbearable. It's really well done. Yet, apart from the tension and high drama throughout, I did feel a little bit disappointed by the end of the movie, because there's actually not that much that happens, except the two protagonists encountering one danger after another as they trudge through the dreary landscape. And the other thing is that for a movie about a father-son relationship, I didn't really feel emotionally involved with the characters. Maybe it's just because I don't find Viggo Mortensen very appealing as an actor, but I felt a certain emotional distance from everything that was happening, so didn't feel much payoff by the end of the movie. I should mention, though, that there is a brief but really powerful performance by an unrecognizable Robert Duvall. He gives the most moving performance in the film, I reckon. The film also raises some profound ethical issues, although it doesn't really deal with them in a very satisfying way, I thought. First of all, there's the question, why go on living? Why not just kill yourself and be done with it? What's the point in living if there are no other humans around except a few cannibal freaks? And the other interesting question is, well, if you do decide to go on living, then why be moral? Why treat other people ethically when your own survival may be at stake? The film does touch somewhat on this issue. The father keeps telling his son that they're the good guys and the cannibals are the bad guys. And the son asks if they will ever have to become bad guys too. The pair eventually do encounter other fellow wanderers, and this question becomes more stark. Why help people? Why share your food with them when you may just be limiting your own survival? Why not use them? Why not kill them and eat them? or at least take everything you can from them. Why not? Seriously, why not? Do ethical principles have any meaning in a world where there is no law or even society to speak of? Why be ethical under these conditions? During the movie, the boy is like the voice of conscience wanting to help other people they encounter, but the father is more wary and reluctant to go to the aid of others. Who's right? I don't know. There is no answer. But these are really interesting questions that I wish the film might have delved into a little bit deeper. Apart from those small gripes, I do have one main gripe with The Road. And that is that there were three moments in the film that suddenly wrenched me out of the story and reminded me, this is not real. They're just Hollywood actors in a Hollywood movie. And it's really annoying when that happens in a film as tense and engrossing as this one. Two of those moments were because of two really obvious cases of product placement from the great Coca-Cola Corporation. At one point in the film, the father and son are searching a deserted office building and find a can of Coke. The boy, who was born after the apocalypse, has never seen Coca-Cola before. So he opens the can with much anticipation and tastes it and exclaims that it's bubbly and tastes so good. Please, couldn't they have thought of something a little more subtle? Well, the other example of product placement is a little more subtle, but no less annoying. This is when they stumble upon a stash of food, and amongst the products they happily consume is a bottle of, can you guess? Yes, it's vitamin water, another great product from the Coca-Cola family, and also a particular favorite of ours here on Reality Check, one that we discussed in some depth on the show a couple of weeks ago. The final incident that snapped me out of the world of the movie momentarily and made it clear that I was watching actors on a film set was when, at one point, they find a waterfall and go for a swim in the pool underneath it. Viggo Mortensen strips off completely, but the boy goes in wearing a singlet and boxer shorts. Now, if it was just a father and son in a world devoid of humans, why would the kid wear clothes to go swimming? The only reason is because this is a Hollywood movie and a lot of conservative, puritanical American viewers are watching. And for some unknown reason, in their warped minds, the sight of a 12-year-old boy's buttocks would turn them into, what, depraved pedophiles? I don't know. I don't know what goes on in their narrow little minds. But this kind of complete lack of realism for the sake of the puritanical viewers really annoyed me. But I have to say, these are all minor complaints. And overall, The Road is a very well-made and engrossing movie, and one definitely worth checking out if you get the chance. And that brings us to the end of the 25th episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 10 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 26. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.